Welcome to Creating Ripples, the program that showcases inspirational women across the globe. You don't have to be a Mother Teresa to make an impact on the world. Sometimes the small acts and achievements can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry, and they will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing the fabulous and beautiful Diana Crouch. Diana is a founder member of the Black Parent Network, which was set up to provide support to Black parents and their children across a range of issues from education, health and parenting to social and welfare issues. In particular, the group had major concerns with underachievement of Black children in the education system in the United Kingdom and the overrepresentation of young people in the criminal justice system. The Black Parent Network has been consulted by the London Mayor's Office for its recent education inquiry and was also consulted to give its views on a report it prepared on illegal school exclusions for the Prime Minister's Office in the UK. Previously, Diana was a director at Amnesty International and a senior manager at the British Red Cross. Today, Diana runs her own marketing consultancy, Crouch Consulting, working for a range of corporate clients and has developed a range of proven income generation and marketing skills for business and not-for-profit organisations. Diana, welcome. Thank you very much for being interviewed.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
It's a joy to be interviewing you. Tell us a bit about where you've come from.
Well, I'm the eldest of six children. My parents come from Jamaica, and I was born in the north of England, in Leeds. And I went to Nottingham University and went through the corporate route, and found that eventually my heart laid in human rights causes. And so I went back to university and did a master's in human rights. And that's when I decided that I couldn't go back to the corporate sector ever again, not full time, and decided to look for something that was more congruent with who I feel I am, which is a human rights activist. Good. And so that's how I ended up working for Amnesty International and the British Red Cross. Years later, after the birth of my daughter, Natasha, I decided that I would work for myself so that that would give me more flexibility as a parent. You know, again, I found even in the not-for-profit sector that there isn't a huge amount of allowance for being a woman and a mother, that I had to prioritise my daughter. And so if you want to earn enough money to live and you want to work, and I do, always have worked, that the best way to do that is to work for myself. So that's why I decided to set up Crouch Consulting.
Amazing. I mean, what fascinates me is just a throwaway comment when you were talking about where you've come from was that you realised, you know, your heart, your passion was in human rights. Was there a particular instance? Was there a game changer moment that actually made you? What was the realiser behind that realisation for you?
Well, I think there are several. I think growing up in the UK at that time, as a young Black person, I felt very excluded from mainstream opportunities. It didn't seem to be enough to be bright and able and capable and so on. The fact that I was a Black woman seemed to be a negative that could get in the way of opportunities. I mean, I've actually gone out of my way to turn being a Black woman and who I am into an advantage. And in fact, I was telling somebody just yesterday that when I send out applications for anything, I tend to put a little photograph of myself on that so they can see who I am. And the good people out there in the universe will that are just looking for the right person will be interested in my confidence in who I am and want to speak to me. The not so nice people who don't want to meet somebody like me won't be inviting me along anytime soon.
And in fairness, you wouldn't want to be meeting them anyway, would you?
I wouldn't want to be meeting
them
anyway.
They're not your people.
I wouldn't want to be meeting them anyway. But in any case, I think that to meet that sort of negativity with positivity and confidence is the right way. And also, as an individual, that I think that I should state my claim on the planet. You know, I have the right. I'm a human being, just the same as, you know, a white male is a human being or a white female is a human being. I should be proud of who I am. And so I've made it a deliberate kind of ploy, if you like, to always put myself out there forward as a black woman. And I think that that's part of my thinking behind human rights, that who I am, who I am defines my humanity, it underlines my philosophy and everything that I do, and also everybody else's rights. So whoever you are, whether you're a Muslim, disabled, lesbian, whatever, I think that you still have the same rights as I do. I think that the best way for me to live my life and feel that I'm congruent, that I'm actually sincere and authentic, is to follow that path. You know, be confident in who I am and respect who other people are. And growing up in an environment where I felt very excluded as a young black person, I thought it was really important to educate myself and to take every opportunity. But one of the things that I did find growing up is that not everybody is like me. Not everybody can be as strong and as confident as me and as defiant as me. And that some people need more help and more support. And so that's been part of my life's work as well.
That can come as quite a shock, can't it? Because we are our only benchmark. Ourselves, so it is easy to assume that everybody thinks the way we think.
Yeah.
And it can come as quite a shock when you realize that actually people don't think the way that you think. They don't have, we all have different characters, and as we go through life and mature ourselves, we realize actually part of the gift that we can give back is to help the people who are different to us. But there's also a fine line, which is me talking from my experience. When I was younger, I was so hungry that everybody was positive and saw was a glass half full, not a glass half empty, that I did an awful lot of projecting. So I expected people, oh, for goodness sake, you know, do this. If you do X, Y, and Z, everything will be lovely. And the biggest lesson for me was to know when to walk away and to accept that some people are actually really happy exactly where they are and they don't want to change. And as I've matured, I've realised that actually I've stopped rescuing. So it's switched from rescuing people to empowering people. But it's very subtle, that shift, but it's about the energy that you give out to people. So how do you balance that? How do you balance from where you are today empowering people who want to change, but not expecting everybody to come with you?
Well, I mean, to sort of quickly go back to your previous question about game changers, is as you know, I started the Black Parent Network around 2004, and you know, so that will, if I look at that, that will kind of answer your question about how I empower. I aim to empower other people. And the reason behind starting the Black Parent Network was that I could see that, like myself, a lot of other parents were struggling with certain issues. So struggling with an education system that has a lot of built-in barriers for success for black kids, if you allow that to happen. But you don't have to allow that to happen, but it's that knowledge. And we can empower each other by sharing knowledge. So we could share knowledge about the national curriculum. We can share knowledge about how best to support our children through the school system. We can share knowledge about how to prepare our children for school when they're very young and you know, they're still at home or at nursery school. And also if there are problems, what to do, how we can support each other as parents and support our children. So, for instance, through school exclusions, underachievement, what can you do? And increasingly what I found amongst my peers were other Black parents felt disempowered. We were isolated from each other. We didn't have a network where we could share information. Very often we found institutions like schools or local education authorities and so on were not helpful. They were punitive. They didn't understand cultural differences, so issues that were important to us. So, for instance, you know, there were cases of children being excluded for school for not having their hair the right way, you know, because they had braids in, extensions in. And I remember one school had excluded some girls for having their hair braided because they said there were a fire risk.
Oh, for goodness sake.
In science, yeah, the Bunsen burners in science. So, you know, a myriad of issues. And where we came to was the fact that if we had a pool of information and resources and support when we were going through these individual instances of what we thought and still think is discrimination or at least insensitivity to our cultural needs, we could share that information and that knowledge to improve the outcomes for our children. And so obviously we can better parent them. And so in terms of empowering, I think knowledge is important. It's central to that. And the Black Parent Network aims to share information, share knowledge, signpoint resources and this kind of thing. So on a personal level, I do think that it's about making sure that you at least know and you've got the support if you want to take advice and support. I mean, sometimes you've got to let people walk another path. You know, there are some parents that I come across where I just wonder why you know, they've ever bothered to have children because they just don't seem, no, quite seriously, because they just don't seem to get it that, you know, children need a certain amount of support and love and nurturing and discipline. It's all part of your role as a parent, but you don't know what you don't know. And very often in the Black community, I find that particularly with very, very young parents that have perhaps come from, you know, a background where they don't have strong parenting themselves, you know, they haven't got that framework. They don't understand that framework. Sure. They don't have that knowledge. But if we come together as a community, we can support, we can offer support, we can offer information, we can offer resources, and we can empower.
Has it had an impact on changing opinions? So when you say that sometimes the curriculum isn't supportive, you know, that girls are excluded for ridiculous reasons, how can the Black Parent Network influence change with the culture, with a predominantly white-dominated education system?
That's a good question. And one of the things that we're working on at the moment is producing a Black Family Charter. So that's going to be a blueprint, a policy document for lawmakers, policymakers to give guidance and signposting really about the cultural issues and the important social and economic issues that affect Black families. I mean, in fact, they don't just affect Black families, they affect families from poorer backgrounds, underprivileged backgrounds, and a lot of other ethnic minority families come across similar sorts of issues. But we're focusing on Black families because we thought that, we still think that African Caribbean children in particular in the UK experience a huge amount of discrimination in the education system, for instance. Social and welfare issues also mean that those families tend to face barriers that perhaps, you know, if they were born in their own, from the host community, let's say, they would not face those similar barriers.
Mm.
And I'm trying to say this diplomatically.
Don't be diplomatic. Just tell it how it is like.
Trying to say this diplomatically.
You don't need to be diplomatic with
but,
me.
But what I'm trying to say is that I think that it's really important that we have a coming together as a community where we put forward to government a framework document that explains in education these are the key issues that affect African Caribbean families, in welfare through some of the penal reforms that have gone on in the past 20, 30 years, how that has differentially affected Black families, mm-hmm. and you know, what we think can be done to make the system fairer. And also to give policymakers a heads up. There's no point in us just complaining all the time about how the government isn't doing this and the government isn't doing that. As a community, you know, we can take responsibility for what happens in the future. I mean, we are voters, in fact.
So, you know, and it's about sharing the ownership, isn't it? And coming out of the blame culture.
Because, yeah.
I mean, it's... Globally, I think a lot of people live in the blame culture because it's actually much easier to blame somebody else. It takes courage and a bit of work to own a problem, to own a challenge and to do something about it. But it's only once we own what's going on for ourselves internally can we then influence our external perception of the world and our worldview. So what you're empowering Black families to do is to take ownership of the issue and not blame the white government. And it is, I'm ashamed to say, as a white as a white British person, you could probably count the number of Black MPs on one hand in all the parties, not just the governing party, but in all parties, which in the 21st century is an appalling state of affairs.
Yeah, it's quite shocking. It is quite shocking. And I think what is also really sad is the poor amount of consultation that goes on, and that very often when consultations are done, it's with hand-picked individuals that are part of the establishment for whatever reason. I mean, the Black Parent Network likes to see itself as being run by ordinary parents. Fair enough, you could say we're middle class, or, you know, we have a lot of professionals on board, but they are in fact Black parents. And one of the interesting things about being Black is it's a huge leveler. It doesn't really matter whether or not you're a high-powered lawyer, doctor, professional living in the suburbs, driving a very nice car, sending your children to private school. I don't find that those parents experience any less discrimination. I think that it's just different. You know, we, as I said, I mean, you know, when you're Black, you just simply are, and discrimination can appear in many forms. And in fact, it can be a bit more insidious if you are, you know, not living in a community where somebody's going to look you straight in the eye and call you a Black, you know what, directly to your face. It can be a lot more subtle.
Which is more dangerous. Sometimes.
Which can be more dangerous.
Because we're dealing with an historic unconscious bias, aren't we?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there will be a shift. Because I think the black-white issue is an historical one. But now what I'm seeing is that is a shift towards discrimination in this country. And it started off with Eastern Europeans when we had an influx when, you know, the Berlin Wall went down in the early 90s, and we suddenly the whole of Europe opened up and we had an influx of Eastern Europeans coming over. Now, what scares me as a white British person is it then going to shift to refugees with the whole refugee crisis with Syria? Are we ever, as a human race, going to get past blame and discrimination?
Well, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. And I think that the whole point about the refugee situation and the refugee crisis is very often one of economics, anxiety about resources and sharing and so on and so forth. So, you know, I guess for coming from a family of immigrants myself, I can see that, I can understand that. And in fact, interestingly, I can hear amongst my parents' generation now, they are talking about incoming refugees in the same way that they were perhaps talked about themselves historically. Mm-hmm. The difference being is that they're not talking about them because they're, you know, a certain color or a certain religion. They're just talking about the fact that, you know, maybe there's not enough, there aren't enough school places right. in local doctors and this sort of thing, and jobs and this sort of thing. So all the, you know, the historical stereotypes about what happens when you get a big influx of people, what's going to happen to the economies, they're more focused right. on that. It tends not to be a around, you know, yeah. race and religion yeah. and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
What does tend to be more frightening is that the British press does talk about people's ethnicity and religion and so on and so forth. And interestingly, it took for the death of that 3-year-old boy on a beach
yeah.
Recently when yeah. those photographs zoomed out across the world, we saw a very different shift in the way that the British press then talked about refugees after that, because previously it was a lot of they were almost talking about refugees that were desperately fleeing as if they were criminals that were just, you know, economic migrants and so on and so forth. And now they're talking about them properly as refugees.
And as human beings.
Yeah.
A couple of things kind of popped up as you were talking then. One was, do you see what you're doing with the Black Parent Network in the UK is transferable globally where there are similar issues?
Most definitely I do. I mean, I think that any minority group is naive if it thinks that it can complain from the sidelines and get change. What we need to do as a minority, and a significant minority that's growing and growing in this country in particular, is to realise that when we organise and when we use our power as voters, as residents that pay taxes and so on and so forth, as homeowners, as people that work and pay taxes, that gives us a huge amount of power. And what we need to do is to harness that, not in a way to intimidate to disrupt, but to collaborate and to bring change. That means that we live in a more equitable society, because I think at the moment we are quite disparate as a group. You know, the Black community has, because of our history and the diaspora and so on and so forth in Europe, in particular, I think that we tend to live in our little sort of local fractions. So the Jamaicans are in their own community, the Africans are in their community, and so on and so forth. So even on that level, we can look at, you know, within our own community, as fractions. But when we come together as a group, we are very powerful.
You've achieved a huge amount, and we were talking before we started the interview, and you came up with a phrase which I loved, was the power of one, which I absolutely love, which made me think, actually, when people ask me what woman in the past has inspired you, I come up with Rosa Parks, who really was the mother of the civil rights movement in the US. The power of one, and that is phenomenal. So with you as an incredibly powerful woman, if you think of your own power of one, of you, where is Diana going in the future?
Well, certainly I'd like to see myself as a catalyst for change. I'd certainly like to see the framework document, the Black Family Blueprint, the Charter, I'd like to see that materialise and go to government. And I'd like that to be a catalyst for a change, so that we have a legislature, a government that is more sensitive to the needs of Black families. So instead of seeing Black families as a problem that needs public support, they see us as contributors and part of the policy-making machinery for the future.
Well, good for you. I mean, the UK needs you, And thank I think you. Probably the world needs you.
Thank you.
So like
quite grand.
Any
thank
way
you.
That we, you know, you can get a that platform to go out and share this experience and share what you're achieving here, because it is so desperately, desperately needed. And that's what I think what women do particularly well is that we are very good at sharing our knowledge and experience and expertise to the empowerment of others. Diana, it's been an absolute pleasure to
thank you. We could thank go you on. For inviting
clearly
me.
I should have asked to have an hour's interview, not a 30-minute interview.
With thank people, you.
Because we could easily talk for another half an hour. But thank you very much.
Thank
it's
you.
Been a joy. This has been Katie Day, the High Heeled Leader with Creating Ripples, the programme where women are showcased as the fabulous, amazing, awesome human beings we are. Coming up in future weeks, we have an amazing story from Japan, stories from India and Bangladesh, and many more. Be sure to listen in, feel inspired, and create your own ripples.